Hey, are you tired of meeting with prospects only to have them put you off again and again, turning them into yet another missed opportunity? Are you tired of trying to do the same things in meetings and not seeing any improvement in the amount of business you're closing? Do you want to stop giving your time away in hopes that a client will buy something or someday transfer their assets? Well, Whiteboard University is our two-hour live workshop where we will teach you how to have engaging meetings with every prospect and client you meet with, how to quantify your advice so prospects are willing and excited to pay you a financial planning fee, and finally, where we teach you how to explain financial strategies in a dynamic, interesting way that will separate you from all the boring advisors who do the same old thing. If you're serious about having better client meetings and closing business faster, visit WhiteboardU.com today and sign up for one of our live workshops in November. Whiteboard University offers a 100% money-back guarantee if we don't help you improve your communication and meeting skills. That's WhiteboardU.com. We'll see you there.
I came into the industry in 99 when technology bubble is raging and like everybody and their dog thinks they can become a millionaire by trading all the hot .coms, and the internet has just gone live, right? And Charles Schwab has given everybody access to the markets and Fidelity is close behind. And in 1999, because everybody wanted to trade, well, we didn't have the internet structure at that time to support that kind of traffic. So the internet, the web trading websites would go down every day, all day. And people would be so aggravated because they wouldn't be able to trade online. And the only way they could trade was to call into a broker. Well, because of that, Charles Schwab, and I'm sure Fidelity was doing the same thing, but Charles Schwab was hiring 100 people a month into what they called their Build a Broker program. And I'll tell you what, if you could fog a mirror and make a complete sentence, they would hire you to train you to answer those phones. Right. And so I did not go to school to be a financial advisor, never had intentions to be a financial advisor. I went to school to be a teacher. Gotcha. And it's interesting how much overlap there is with financial planning, right? All we are doing is adult education. I mean, you know, it's pretty much the same gig. So I joined Schwab in 99. And honestly, Sten, I'm not sure if I could have articulately told you the difference between a stock and a bond when I was hired. And 18 months later, I was licensed. I was a supervisor of a team of 18, had doubled my salary. And in the first 18 months at Charles Schwab, I placed 5,000 trades with no errors.
Goodness.
It was a crazy time. Absolutely crazy.
So what was the motivation? Was it, I just need a job that's paying well and I'll just try this thing out, and then you kind of fell in love with it? Or at what point did you like, this is going to be my career?
Yeah. You know what? That was, you nailed it on the head. That the reality was, at the time, my husband had gone to Schwab first. We had just relocated from Oregon to Arizona.
Yeah,
you did. And it was like, hey, this is a great opportunity to learn something new and exciting. Yep. And I'm just somebody who kind of will float to the top no matter what I'm doing. And so I was like, all right, yeah, let's do this. But I didn't really fall in love with it until the bubble burst, until after 2000, when all of a sudden now the stock market is a disaster area. And everyone out there is like, maybe this isn't quite as easy as we thought. And for the first time in the company's history, they start providing portfolio level advice to clients and having relationship based practices. And I was like, sign me up. I like the relationships with the people. I was all about the people. So in 2003, I was one of only three women portfolio managers in the country in our private client division. Worked my way up through private client until 2011. I actually went through my own divorce in 2007, learned about this credential that I have now, a certified divorce financial analyst. And I thought, wow, you know, I really love to help people not make the financial mistakes that I made in my divorce. And so I went to management at the time and said, hey, I'd really like to get this credential. And they laughed at me and said, oh, no, no, no. Legal risk compliance. Yeah. Why don't you go get that paraplanner designation? And so I finally did kind of orchestrate my exit, and I left and went independent 2011. Started my own company as an outside business activity, Smarter Divorce Solutions, where I could specialize in divorce financial planning. And so that was 2011. So fast forward 13 years, I pretty actively have managed three businesses, my wealth practice, the divorce practice. And then in 2014, I started teaching and training financial advisors all over the country on how to have these divorce niche practices. So I actually am winding, I sold my main wealth practice a couple of years ago. I have just a small boutique practice now. And I'm actually have employees kind of taking over a lot of the divorce business. And I am really focusing more on my teaching and training at this point in my career.
Nice. I love that. What, and then you've come full circle to the teaching. Yeah. Great.
Exactly. Right where I was supposed to end up in the first place.
Oh, that. Yeah. Well, a lot of times when we're coaching advisors, if you can position yourself as a teacher coach first, it's the way you present things, the questions you ask, because I look back and I was trained in one of the big companies that, you know, gets a bunch of people in, not a lot of them survive. You know, if you're the strongest, good luck. 10 years from now, you may have a good business. And, you know, I feel like that's kind of what a lot of us accepted as the path for a long time. But it's more challenging than it has to be to find in what way can I present myself to the public where I'm generous, not product focused, but also run a healthy business. So as you leaned into the divorce side, because some of my best clients, my mom was divorced, but it's part of my story. Like, it's just a lot that I was like, if my mom would have only known certain things when she was taking care of four of us kids on her own, and every time she fell on the wrong side and had no idea, nobody couldn't afford to hire the right people. It could be a great market, but I don't think it's one in my experience that you can just kind of stumble into and succeed in. You might get some one-offs, but to do it well, what was that transition like for you? And I'd love to kind of go deeper into, like, for our advisors listening, if they do run into somebody that's going through a divorce, what are some really practical things they should know?
Thank you very much for that, because you're absolutely right. One of my pet peeves is advisors that dabble in the divorce space, because you've got people's entire futures in your hands and you don't really know what you don't know. And so the stakes are very high. And so, yes. So when you get start out and you get that CDFA credential, it's just like getting a CFP. Even when you pass that CFP exam, you're not really ready to go out there and be a full-fledged planner, right? You've got so much more to learn and so much more experience to get. And the same thing was true for me. And so I went to my first conference for the divorce for professionals and was really looking for people who had gone before me and done it well. And like all the speakers at the conference were talking about taking 8-9 years to build up their businesses. And I was like, I don't have 9 years to build up a business. And I've had my own businesses in the past and I'm pretty scrappy. And I got back and I was like, all right, hold my beer. I got stuff to do. And I just hit it. I mean, I hit it. I got out there. I talked to everybody. I built the business on a shoestring. I felt very, very strongly that I was not going to spend a lot of money on it until I was making the money on it. So it was grassroots, build it on a shoestring. And 18 months later, I was averaging 3 to 5 cases a month. Oh. And when you talk about a divorce case, the revenue that you generate from a divorce case on average is about $5,000. Yes. So I had a 6-figure divorce practice within 18 months. And if you think about that, even if I have 3 clients a month, that's 36 qualified prospects a year for my wealth side. Mm-hmm. I built my wealth practice so much faster by having that niche than I ever would have if I was going to compete with the other 5,000 financial advisors in town that are all offering the same stuff. So one of the things that I think is really important for all the financial advisors that are listening is, with the advent of artificial intelligence, robo investments, we have to be able to differentiate ourselves in this market, or we're not going to be relevant anymore. So niching has become more and more and more important. Mm. So for the average financial planner, CFP advisor, when you have clients getting a divorce, if they're your own clients, tread carefully. Because your code of ethics as a CFP is very specific on what you can do. You've got to stay neutral. You can't be giving either one of those people advice. So you really need somebody like me, like an outside CDFA, who can come in as a neutral and work with those parties.
And that's the case. And the chance of keeping both of them is probably low as an advisor. I don't know if historically one leaves. Do you kind of say, hey, I'm going to stay here, you need to get your own advisor? Or do you try to bring in a third party and keep both clients? Because in your experience, is there a better way? I mean, ideally, we keep them both and we might fight for that, but is that the right thing?
It is, if you've done the right thing along the way. Okay. And unfortunately, there are still a humongous number of advisors that only have a relationship with one of the spouses. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you, if that's the case, the other spouse is leaving. And there are some statistics out there that after divorces, 75% of the women will find a new advisor. Yeah. So if you're not engaging those wives in your conversations, in your meetings, it's a huge mistake. Yeah. The number one divorce rate is among people over 55, our target demographic. Yeah. The vast majority of people I work with are between 55 and 80.
Got it.
And you're correct. Most of the women will find new advisors. So that's something really important to think about.
Yeah.
What I encourage advisors to do that are not trained is don't get involved in how they should structure their settlements. Mm. Only do financial planning what if scenarios of, okay, if they're going to plan their property division this way, here's what this one person's financial plan would look like going forward. Yes, you're going to be okay. No, you're not going to be okay. Maybe you should think about more retirement. You know, that's fine. I've had situations though, where I'm working with a couple in like a collaborative divorce situation, and I've had financial advisors blow up my entire settlement. Mm. Because perfect example, this couple had a brokerage account that was a total of about $5 million. So they had one core account, three managed accounts, and then I think a fixed income account. Now, obviously, I understand as a married couple, this was all structured at a portfolio.
Yeah.
The advisor is giving wife the advice that all of these accounts should be split, each one 50-50. Keep everything intact, keep the portfolio intact. Mm-hmm. Well, I understand as an advisor that makes sense for you to keep both clients and keep the business.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at so much more. I'm looking at tax optimization. I'm looking at who's keeping the house, who needs to buy a house in the future. And the reality is, I could have saved that couple $150,000 in taxes if the wife would have taken my recommendations to not divide all those accounts and take retirement assets instead. Mm. But because the advisor had told her this was how it should be done, she was anchored on that and they had a strong relationship. Yeah. And even though I could sit there and say, it's going to cost you another 150 grand in taxes. No, it's okay. That's what he said I should do.
Yeah.
So just, you know where your expertise ends and where someone else's begins.
Yeah,
I would say the most important advice is, if your clients are getting a divorce, anyone you know getting a divorce, make sure they bring in a financial expert. I can't tell you how many people are getting divorces with attorneys that have never been trained in finance. That's not what they do.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of attorneys and they're like, no, we stay away from that. We can't give advice on that. Do people not bring another expert in mainly because of the expense of it? Is it they just don't know that kind of person exists? The attorneys just don't want another cook in the kitchen? Like, what's the what's the landscape out there if an advisor is trying to get into this space? Like, what are they going to run into?
Yeah, all of the above. There are attorneys that are very, very collaborative and will recommend to their clients that they bring in a specialist. There seems to be universally this fear that, look, in every divorce, you're giving away half your stuff. So there's this universal fear that I'm going to be in poverty and I'm losing everything I've worked for. How am I possibly going to survive? I can't possibly pay another professional. I've paid my attorney $30,000 and now they want me to pay someone else. It's a time of dramatic overwhelm and uncertainty. And unfortunately, most of the attorneys, because they're not versed in finance, they don't know how to articulate the benefit.
Yeah.
They don't know how to tell their clients why it's so important that they bring us in.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm real passionate about, is educating the public how important this is. And we're not talking about savings of, you know, $1,000 here and there, tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars difference in their outcomes. Yes. So it can be really powerful.
Calculated, I'm sure. Like any level of, you know, compounding the benefits from that, it's that number just gets bigger. That's great. So when it comes to your practice, when it was kind of at its peak, I read some things. Did you get to where you made kind of $1 million in fees in a year?
I did. I hit $1 million revenue practice at combined businesses. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is a really interesting thing, right? Because when I first started, I was really, really clear on what I wanted to create. Mm-hmm. I wanted to build businesses that were going to run without me. Yeah. So that I could be the CEO. I could have junior advisors. I could have, you know, more staff on the divorce side. And at the peak, I had 11 full-time employees.
Wow.
And I was making less money than I'd made before.
Yeah.
And I was miserable. And it was just constant chaos and stress. And I was like, you know what? I'm glad I did it. I set the goals. I achieved the goals. And now I'm going to unwind it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to wind it back down and I'm going to practice what I preach, which is build the business that lets you live the life you want to live.
Yeah.
And so now I'm creating more of that lifestyle practice.
Yeah. Bigger's not always better. I was interviewing this business owner in Florida once when I was writing a book, or putting together a framework for a potential book. And he had grown a business to like 250 employees. And he was like, I was making less money than I did when I had 50 employees as far as being an owner. And I had a lot more complexity because I've learned a lot of times the team members and the people, even though I love it and the culture piece and pouring into people, like it's rewarding, but it's also kind of the heaviest part of being an entrepreneur to some degree. What for you, was it just the management of people, motivating them, keeping them kind of focused on the end goal? Was that the piece that became the most overwhelming, or was it just too much going on across the board?
What I was forced to realize is really super successful humans have some qualities that are incredibly unique. And we tend to expect that everyone operates in the same way that we do. And so there's this idea that everyone is self-motivated, everyone is self-driven, everyone wants to grow and be the best. And you know what? They just don't. And that's okay. But when you're a small business, you need A players in every single seat. But then the realization came that, oh, the A players are actually out there with their own businesses. So it just became a real challenge to find the quality of people that I needed to be able to grow, to be successful, and realizing that, oh, they're already out there being successful, doing their own thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just a constant battle. I mean, and I had some really great quality employees, really good team members, and life happens, right? Somebody gets married and moves to Florida. Oh, gotta replace that person. And you know, when you want to replace a key employee, that's a 6-month process to replace somebody and get them trained and up to speed. And it's not easy. And, you know, the big firms have all of that bandwidth and training departments and all of the resources. And when you're a small business, you don't have all that at your fingertips. And so it's just a much tougher juggle.
Yeah, I found, yeah, I'm in that where it's like, hey, we're going on all cylinders. Somebody, you know, decides to stay home. They move for something, and it does the ripple effect. I think if it's one advisor and a few staff, you know, I think that's a safe place. And I know a lot of advisors that hang out there. Once you reach like a critical mass where you have a director of development, and you know, then you're great. But I do feel, I don't know if it's most of us, we kind of live in this, we're entrepreneurs, we want to hire people, we want to grow to some degree. But still, every change is still impactful enough, the replacement of it. So yeah, I feel that tension. And it sounds like you sat in it for a while, which a lot of us do. And it feels that there is a healthy period to where you either sell it, transition to somebody else. But I don't know if winning is you have to do that forever.
Right.
It almost feels like a season. So you're ahead of me in it, but that's just kind of what I feel like I'm seeing is the hope someday is that, you know, legacy isn't about Sten anymore. It's people rise up and kind of take it. And then I get to watch from afar and be like, man, they're doing great. And I get to work with my core clients, which it sounds like you're doing. So
exactly.
Yeah, it's helpful to hear you say that, because when I feel less alone in like the difficulty of it, but also like, okay, there's a future season there too that sounds a little simpler.
right. And so I got to the point where this idea of bringing on, you know, associate advisors that could groom to take over for me, you know, I really realized I'd been fishing in the wrong pond. I'd been bringing in people from big boxes, you know, Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab, that were not entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And they couldn't live in this world. And so ultimately, I started looking at merger possibilities.
Yeah.
And I identified the perfect culture firm that matched my culture. Mm-hmm. And we positioned it to clients as a merger, where I am now the divorce specialist.
Right.
And this is your planner, and this is your investment manager. And that made for a pretty smooth transition. Okay. And worked pretty well.
That's great. Let's jump back to the divorce kind of specific piece. If we could try to almost boil down, let's say an advisor has a client getting divorced, or they're getting pulled into a situation. They don't have the designations yet. They haven't done it for years. What are a few things that you would say? Here are the basics, the foundations, the obvious landmines that you could see every single time. Because we do have advisors listening that will get it pulled into something that don't really have the time to become the expert right away, but we want them to be better equipped as quick as possible.
Yeah. You know, the simple things that you can help your clients with, what can be divided and what can't be divided. I've seen so many court ordered property settlements to divide an annuity that can't be divided.
Mm-hmm.
And if we sacrifice it, we're going to give up this giant guarantee and pay the penalties, right? So what can be split? What does not need to be split? And optimizing for taxes as much as you can. So typically when a couple is going to divorce, they pretty much know already who's keeping the house.
Yeah.
So there's and that's usually a significant asset. Well, most people, and certainly most attorneys, think in terms of every single piece has to be equalized.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have a client that thinks, okay, well, I have $500,000 in equity, so I'm going to have to pull out $250,000 in a mortgage. Well, no, you don't. You can give a different asset instead. And let's say they have a large retirement portfolio. Well, yeah, we can give money from retirement, but pre-tax money is not the same as post-tax money. So let me help you figure out what is that equalization that's actually going to be appropriate. If you feel confident in it, one of the things that we can always do, I think, as advisors that brings benefit is looking at the couple. If there's a significant difference in income earning ability, mm-hmm. the reality is the higher income earner is always going to be in the higher tax bracket all throughout retirement.
Yeah.
So the more retirement assets we can award to the lower wage earner, mm. let the other person keep the home equity,
mm.
the less money they're going to pay in taxes over the lifetime. And that's money that the two of them get to share. So that's the kind of stuff that a CDFA being brought in will help do, optimize their settlements. Mm. So anytime you've got that complexity, get a CDFA involved who can help with some of that stuff.
And some of that is predicting future tax rates. We don't know what we're saying based on today. Do you find that people kind of buy into that, even though it's kind of based on future assumptions? Or do you find that
they do buy into it? Because look, wherever tax rates go, it's going to impact both of them.
Mm-hmm.
If they go up, it's going up for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, if we look at, okay, one person is going to have only Social Security and maybe a small amount of retirement distribution in retirement, the other one is going to have $150,000 a year pension and Social Security and throw off from all these other investments. Well, obviously, they're going to pay more taxes than the lower income one.
Yeah.
So it really doesn't even matter what the tax rates are in the future.
Yeah.
It's going to be more for that other person. Whereas if we can give them home equity, you know, profits up to $500,000, that's tax-free.
Oh, yeah.
You know, then that's just 39% for that money that they get to share it and actually both benefit from.
That makes sense. So with your training, so we have an advisor's listening. Multiple times throughout my career, I've been to a conference or something and somebody's mentioned the divorce market, some potential clients that come from it. And you're just like, you get excited about it and maybe you get, you know, run after it for a little bit. And then you go back to kind of what you were doing before. If someone says I'm interested in the market, I don't know if that's something I want to niche on fully, but I want to get more well-versed in it. Where can they go? There's that designation, but what trainings do you have? What could be a next step for them?
Really, the designation is the first thing. And it's an easy designation to get. You can get the CDFA designation in about 3 months.
Okay.
And that's generous. I mean, if you get a lot of time, I mean, I got it in a month because I had a lot of time on my hands. So my trainings are all designed for people after they've gotten that designation.
Okay.
And first thing I do is I host a 2-day conference that is, okay, you have your designation, now what? And I spend 2 days really saying, okay, how do you grow this business? How do you really niche in this business? What do you do for marketing? But then what do you do with the clients once you have them? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a neat thing because at the end of that 2-day event, usually about half of the attendees are fired up and ready to go. And the other half are like, whoa, this is way more than I thought and I'm out. And that's good too, right? No, figure that out before you get involved in it.
I love that. Where would people go to learn about the designation? I guess maybe, I don't know if both of them live on your website and then the conference, where could we kind of direct them?
So generally for the designation, you want to go to institutedfa.com, which is the Institute for Divorce Financial Analysts. And that's all of the information about the credential and how to get the credential. And then my training programs are all on divorcefinancialtraining.com. And it has all of the different training opportunities that I have available.
That's great. Yeah, I think for those that have been impacted by divorce in their life, I think it's a meaningful niche. But I think to everyone listening, do it well. Be intentional about it. Try not to dabble. You know, when I hear a CPA is doing taxes and then doing some money management on the side, anything where it feels like it's a revenue grab or something, I think we're all better than that. We need to take it seriously. So I love this niche. So Nancy, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're so welcome, Stan. Thanks very much for having me. And yeah. And if any of your listeners are interested in just like, hey, tell me more about this niche, I'm happy to talk with anybody anytime.
That sounds great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.